Hello, Larry and Lina. We're talking this morning to two Chicago poets, Larry Sawyer and Lina Ramona Vitkauskas. Larry has curated the Myopic Books Poets Poetry Reading Series in Wicker Park, Chicago, since 2005. He was chosen as Best Poet in Chicago by the Chicago Reader in its 2012 Best of Chicago Readers poll. He is co-director of the Chicago School of Poetics and editor of Milk Magazine. His new poetry collection is Unable to Fully California, and he is also author of Vertigo Diary. Our second poet, Lina Ramona Vitkauskas, is a Lithuanian-American-Canadian poet, author of Spiny Retinas, Professional Poetry, A Neon Tryst, Honey is a She, The Range of Your Amazing Nothing, and other collections. Too many to name, Lina. Lina has been a faculty member and marketing director of the Chicago School of Poetics, and she is co-editor, along with Larry, of Milk Magazine. Good morning, both of you. Lina,
good morning.
I'm going to start with you, Lina. If you could describe your poetry to us.
Oh, that's a difficult question, but I'll try my best. I take a lot of my influence from the surrealist, capital S surrealist. And a lot of my poetry comes from dream work. But being bilingual most of my life, I think I draw a lot of my inspiration for my poems from the way that language sounds juxtaposed. So a lot of ideas, when I start to write a poem, a lot of ideas just start with how language sounds. How words sound together. So having that background, having different kind of languages in my head, that is a good starting point for me. But I would definitely say dream work, surrealism, anything that sounds nonsensical but could be made sense once it's put next to one another. So I really like language play more than anything.
Now, I noticed on your website that you describe yourself as a language photographer. What does that mean?
Well, basically, it's capturing a moment in time, much like a photographer does, but with language, because I feel that, you know, once we start playing with language on a page, you know, once that strike of inspiration happens, sometimes that moment of excitement with when you put language together really doesn't happen again. So like a photographer, I'm capturing that moment in time where two parts of language would normally not intersect.
Okay. Larry, describe your poetry to us.
I think I'm writing surrealist influenced poetry, mostly lyric. Some of my more recent writing has somewhat of a conceptual bent to it. It's heavy on imagery, and I occasionally use dissonance to keep things interesting, and I occasionally rhyme too. More often than not, I'm writing a free verse poem, but a recent project has me writing rhymed sonnets, actually. So I guess all of the above.
Okay. I have a question to both of you. Is life more poetic with two poets traveling the world together? Are you each other's first eyes? Do you discuss your poetry?
I'll start. I think it's interesting when I think because we have that commonality, we both, as writers, look at the world in a very similar way. So it is interesting. We're very observant people by nature. And as far as our work goes, I do often show Larry like a first draft of my manuscript or just some singular poems I'm working on. I feel that because we are kind of the same, because we're influenced by kind of the same writers, that also helps. But definitely, I think it does bring something to the larger picture. When we go places or when we're interacting with other people or poets or we're in situations or at readings, I do think that definitely comes into play, the fact that we're both poets. What do you think, Larry?
I show Lena, you know, a lot of first drafts of you know, poems I've written, and I didn't come out through you know, the MFA program, you know, womb that a lot of other poets have in mm-hmm. this country. So I often am writing, and sometimes I occasionally feel like I'm sort of like operating in a vacuum. So it's nice to be able to, you know, run a few lines past Lena. So I definitely tend to show her, you know, poems that I've written, at least in their initial stages.
Okay. And both of you also work together as co-editors on a literary online magazine called Milk Magazine. I believe it's milkmagazine.org. Is that right?
Did I? It's just milkmag.org.
Yeah.
Just milkmag.
Milkmag.org.
Okay. Talk to us about the history. How did Milk Magazine come together, its present day, how you see its future?
I'll let Larry start because it's sort of his baby when we first met. So.
Okay.
I was attending Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio, and I edited this literary magazine, Nexus, for a couple of years. And I thought it was such a great experience. I wanted to keep doing it, so I started a new poetry journal and called it Milk.
Mm-hmm.
That was back in 1998. And I did print one issue and then decided, because, in those days, poetry websites were sort of, you know, it was a new concept to have a poetry website back in 1998. I thought, not only is it cheaper to have a poetry website rather than a print journal, but, I would also probably have a much wider readership. So I decided to, edit a poetry, an online poetry magazine. And I had just met Lena, and she had more, you know, computer and web knowledge than I did at the time. And we banded together, and we were sort of like a two-person band of outsiders, and we decided that we would publish all the poetry that we liked, and we were trying to do something different. And we've been doing it ever since. A good friend of ours, Ross Nielsen, thankfully converted all of our old files just recently over into, was it WordPress?
Yeah, we were able to make the transition from the old platform of our site to WordPress, which is, I know, a lot of people take for granted now because that's usually a starting point for people when they create a site.
Yeah.
Since we had this old static website from 1998, which had been created in like crazy old applications like Front Page and Go Live. Mm. We needed some help, so we had somebody who was thankfully very well versed in that and be able to make that transition smoothly.
So that kind of brought it into the 21st century, and you know, we can share pages, we can tweet pages. It just makes everything more shareable, and it still looks more or less the same. And so I'm really glad to see that it's continued on until the, you know, into the present day.
Aesthetic has really been simple, and we've gotten a lot of comments over the years about the aesthetic of the site. First and foremost, because of its content, it's so versatile. The poetry is very kind of, there is no theme necessarily, but in each issue. And also we feature visual artists, and we were featuring fiction writers for a long time. So it was really just a full annual literary magazine, chock full of good stuff every year.
That's a pretty good history from 1998. And you're right, Larry, back then there wasn't all that much online, but there is certainly now. In fact, today there are so many. How did you differentiate yourself from all the other poetry magazines online? Or literary magazines?
I approached editing a poetry journal with the idea in mind that, you know, stylistically, I would publish what I thought to be the best poetry, you know, either submitted or solicited of a particular style. So within one issue, there could be, you know, rhymed poetry, surrealist poetry, I guess more imagist or objectivist poetry. So there were different types of poetry all under the same cover, because I wanted it to be interesting for a wide range of readers. So that's kind of how I approached it. And I think, I don't know whether that's still true, but I think that was kind of a departure at the time, because most journals I saw back then, whether, you know, print or otherwise, typically would offer sort of like the same kind of poetry throughout an issue. So I wanted more of a variety of different kinds of poetry. So that's kind of how I approached it, because I wanted it to be interesting. So.
Okay. Larry, you also curate the Myopic Books Poetry Series in Wicker Park, Chicago. Tell us about that.
Well, I just moved to Chicago, and Lynn and I were actually asked to read our poetry at Myopic Books by Chuck Stebbleton, who was running the poetry series at the time. And about a year passed after we had read there, and I had become better friends with Chuck. And he actually got a job in Milwaukee at Woodland Pattern Book Center. Because he was leaving town, he sort of handed off the keys to me and asked me if I would like to curate the Myopic Poetry Series. And I jumped at the chance and just loved doing it. So I've been doing it ever since.
So what makes literature, either one of you can answer this, what makes literature in Chicago its own? I assume with all that you participate in the Chicago literary community, is it unique?
Yeah, I would say definitely. The more poets that we meet from all over the United States and also the world, because we've actually hosted international poets that, well, Larry has hosted international poets at Myopic, and it's interesting. Chicago has sort of become somewhat of a mecca of a place for poets to come, because I think there's this air of non-pretension that Chicago offers. That blue-collar work ethic is really strong here, and we're all very accepting of people from all over. So when people come to Chicago and they say, I'm a poet, and they want to get involved in any scene, there's usually a niche for every person's interest. There's activist poets here. There's people who are more experimental. There are people who run series that are in conjunction with university presses. So there really is a wide range of, you know, but it, again, all of those groups, all those smaller groups, all often kind of cross-pollinate. So you see a lot of the same poets and writers at different events and so forth. And so it's also a very friendly vibe, I would say, very non-judgmental and very open to new ideas. I think a good model for the poetry scene of Chicago was in the 90s, the theater scene. A lot of people from New York were coming to Chicago knowing that they could do something very different in theater without having a lot of, you know, expense or consequences, give or take, whether it was a success or failure. And so I think that model of the theater scene also kind of spread into the poetry scene in Chicago. It's kind of an anything goes mentality.
Okay. Lynn,
yeah, I think audiences here are very receptive to new ideas. You know, I'm not saying that that's not the case in other major cities, but it seems like experimentation and innovation in Chicago, there's just a long history, whether it's architecture, performing arts, visual arts. It seems like Chicago still welcomes innovation.
Would you say it's an advantage to live in a bigger city, say, than Kalamazoo as a writer?
I think because of the internet, you know, it's not really necessary to actually function as a writer, and you know, it's not really necessary to live in a large city in order to function as a writer. But I think the thing about being in Chicago, one is able to get out and witness, you know, poetry happening, because there's just so many events going on all the time. So that's probably the primary element that might be missed out on, you know, if one were to decide, you know, I'm gonna move to you know, like Wyoming or something, and I'm going to write poetry, and I have the internet. So that's the thing that, for me, makes Chicago so exciting is to hear live poetry is really great.
Lena, you and I should...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Lena, you and I share a Baltic heritage. How does your Lithuanian background, a second language, a second culture, how does that contribute to your writing?
Interestingly enough, when I was completing my master's thesis at Rice State University, I did my thesis on this. I kind of examined the what I was calling at that time the atavistic nature of my writing, which is trying to identify certain characteristics of my writing that reflected back, perhaps subconsciously, on like the type of maybe attitudes or idiosyncrasies that our people share. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the conclusion that I came to was that the interest in nature is often a big part of my poetry, or actually utilizing nature as a way to leverage language. Mm-hmm. Because, as you know, as Baltic peoples, we were pagan for many years before we were Christian.
Yeah.
And so the worship of, you know, gods and goddesses of thunder and rocks and trees. So there is a very, there's a reverence for nature in my work. And I think that's a big part of it. I also think, too, the absurdity of life. I think because the Baltic peoples went through so much turmoil and oppression over the large span of history by multiple oppressors, you know, Poland mm-hmm. and Sweden and Russia. And so there's a sense of like kind of laughing at the absurdity of life or examining it from a like an outward perspective, an outsider perspective, because our nationality was sort of robbed of us on numerous occasions. And so there was that aspect of not being able to express oneself very openly. So I found that that kind of was an interesting part that was inside of me that I had to tease out in my writing, and it came out in the form of kind of rebellious writing, which is earlier when I had mentioned about juxtaposing crazy language together. I think that's a sort of form of rebellion in my writing.
Mm. Larry, you've said elsewhere that poets today spend a lot of time on the internet, and you mentioned that earlier today, too, and that that's similar to gazing into a distorted mirror. Can you explain that?
I think, you know, with social media, it's kind of like, you know, there are benefits, but also drawbacks. And I see that, you know, especially recently with news that, you know, Facebook is now conducting experiments on its users.
Yeah. So
I guess when I signed on to Facebook originally, I had this sense that, you know, nothing really on Facebook is private. You know, that's a well-duh kind of statement. But I think that social media can also be used to have a beneficial effect, because I know that, you know, being quote-unquote friends with many other poets who are living elsewhere, being friends with those people online has allowed me to, number one, you know, learn who they are as people, mm-hmm. In addition to being poets, and also to come into contact with their work. So it really has, as a poet, I think, put me in touch with the world, whether it was, you know, through editing Milk Magazine, or just writing a poem in the morning and posting it on my Facebook page and, you know, seeing what the response might be. So
yeah,
I think it is a distorted version of reality, though. So it's probably best to bear in mind that, you know, experiencing life by going outside is preferable, you know, to sitting inside and spending hours and hours online, for me anyway.
Yeah, keeping a balance in there. You're both involved with the Chicago School of Poetics. Is it fair to call you founders as well, or?
Actually, Francesco Lovato is the founder of the school.
Can you explain what it is, Larry?
A few years ago, I think it's been almost 3 years now, you know, Francesco had this idea that he wanted to start a school, and he wanted to start a school that would offer on location as well as online courses.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of broached the topic one night when he and his wife, Laura, were sitting with, me and Lena were having some dinner, and he presented this idea, and we all kind of pitched in, and the result of that was that a school was started, and it's primarily online now. Like for going on 3 years now, we've had students from all over the world. It's been really interesting because with our live visual conferencing software, the students actually, will see a thumbnail video image in real time of the instructor as well as the other students.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of file sharing, video sharing, sound and video, of course. So as long as the student has the computer requirements necessary, namely a video camera. Most new computers do have a video camera, but it really has allowed us to, cross these vast distances and offer affordable poetry instruction. So I never really tire of talking about poetry. So it just seems logical that I'm teaching a poetry class now.
Yeah. And I've seen on the site that it'll say it's an alternative to the creative writing MFA. If you write at all, that seems to be something that gets pushed at writers quite a bit. How is it an alternative?
I think, namely, it's much more affordable. I've always felt strongly that one doesn't really have to attend a school. With a degree program in order to write poetry.
Mm.
There are many, many poets out there, probably more so than ever, who are writing poetry, and their day job might be in some other field entirely. So,
right.
And we also wanted to offer classes for students who aren't necessarily interested in, taking out a big loan, applying to an MFA program, gaining acceptance. That whole process can be, not only daunting, but
so it's just more inclusive for everyone.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we really accept all students at every level, from novice to advanced. So it is much more inclusive.
Okay. I'd like to ask if both of you could read one of your poems to us so that we get a feel for how you write.
Sure. I'm happy to start.
Okay.
I recently, this was last year, I published a book called The Neon Tryst with Shearsman Books, which is out of the United Kingdom. A wonderful publisher, Tony Fraser, and a wonderful series of books put out by Shearsman, so I was very happy to be a part of that family. This particular book, just to give you just a quick background, was an ekphrastic exercise, and in essence, it speaks to three different films that I had viewed and then wrote poems to those films. So the poem that I'm going to read is from a section of the book that talks to the film Seconds, which was directed by John Frankenheimer in 1966, and it starred Rock Hudson. And basically, the storyline of this movie was that he had committed fake death, suicide, so that he could start a new life. He was working as a banker, and he wasn't the character in the movie. He was working as a banker, not a happy man, and decided he wanted to start a different life as an artist on the West Coast. So a lot of the poems are around this particular character, Arthur Hamilton, so you'll hear that name in this poem. But the first poem I'll read is from the first in the series, and it's called Faith. The faith is a perilous thing, an exercise in longevity, a sterile way pool lips a salty mirror, eyes skewed as butter pats, an opening in the mask, a sock cotton mask, a raving monster in the plaza, an orchid in a hat waiting at the turnstile, an expert in the crowd following the face. Steps upon ceramic, molten earlobes and machinery, a ticket stub, a wet condom. The train pulls away into the tunnel, an unread newspaper. Arthur Hamilton. So that was Face.
Okay, thank you. Larry?
Would you like to hear a rhymed poem or an unrhymed poem?
Oh, heck, you know, that's tempting to answer because you almost never hear rhyming poetry anymore. You've got one of those?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, go for it.
So this project I'm working on most recently has to do with the bestiary with a medieval book form with illustrated plates. And in medieval times, of course, most Europeans had no idea what a giraffe might be or what it would look like or how it would behave. So these bestiaries served one function, and that a couple of functions, but one of them was to show what these animals might look like and how they acted. So this particular poem is about a bird called the tawny frogmouth. The tawny frogmouth sits a head without lid. At the rainforest auction, he will belch a counter bid. Resting quietly with a noose around his heart, this bird sits gloomily like a tree-born start. Forget migration, this midget is staying put, which is not to imply that his life is in a rut. Unlike the owl, this feathered top is no evil omen. Plus, he's more quick-witted than the average Oklahoman. Brown and gray's frumpy camouflage caused a paparazzo to miss him in the entourage. Don't tell the Irish, but this little operator invented the brogue. The fashion-forward drop a look before its vogue. To the bark of every branch applying a craftsman's chisel, what he up to ain't none of your bizzle.
That's great. Thank you both. And if you're ever in Kalamazoo, please let us know.
We will.
Thank you for Thank you for taking time to talk to us today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Anna.